Welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast. I'm Tyler Green. This week, we welcome back one of our most popular guests, artist Shireen Nishat. This weekend, the Detroit Institute of Arts opens a 20-year survey of her work. The exhibition spans from her breakthrough Women of Allah photographs to the recent Book of Kings series that she discussed on episode 11 of the Modern Art Notes podcast. That episode has been downloaded more outside the United States than any program we've ever done. The Detroit exhibition was organized by Rebecca Hart and will remain on view through July 7th. Nishat has previously been the subject of mid-career surveys at half a dozen museums in Europe and North America. She also won the Silver Lion at the 2009 Venice International Film Festival for her film Women Without Men. On the second segment, artist Kelly Richardson joins me to talk about the mid-career survey of her work that will be at the Albright Knox Art Gallery through June 9th. Richardson's video installations meld reality with fantasy, with ecological warning, kind of almost digital trempe-l'oeil. Kelly Richardson, The Last Frontier, was organized by Alastair Robinson for the Northern Gallery for Contemporary Art in Sunderland, England. The Albright is the exhibition's only U.S. stop. But first, Shireen Nishat, after the break.
I'm Max Anderson, director of the Dallas Museum of Art, here to announce DMA Friends, the first free museum membership program in the country. Now, your general admission to the museum is completely free, and you can also enroll to become a DMA Friend. This first-of-its-kind, no-cost membership program incentivizes interaction by letting you earn credits for a variety of rewards. To learn more about how we're becoming everyone's museum of art, visit dma.org.
Pacific Standard Time presents Modern Architecture in L.A., an initiative of the Getty, celebrates Southern California's enduring contributions to modern architecture. Beginning this month, 11 exhibitions, 9 venues, explore the visionary architects and extraordinary building that have made Los Angeles the unique megalopolis it is today. A slate of related discussions, tours, performances, and more also help you discover how the city was made modern. Visit PacificStandardTimePresents.org for a full schedule of exhibitions and events. And we're back. Shireen Nishat, welcome back to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thank you. It's good talking to you again.
So when you look at your earlier video installations, going back to the 1990s, works such as Turbulent and Rapture and so on, do they still have the same topical agency today as they did in the 1990s? Do you exhibit them now and think these topics are still as relevant now as they were 15 years ago? Or do you think that these artworks look back at how it was then?
Well, I don't think that I look at the work in terms of whether they're topical or not, but more about the evolution that the work has taken, I guess, both conceptually and in terms of the form. It's been a long time that I looked at Turbulent and Rapture, and this last week in Detroit, I looked at them again and I realized even my logic of editing and way of storytelling, and there was, you know, kind of rawness about the way in which I made video installations. And it was just, as an artist, it was really interesting for me to see my process and how it has changed and what I was thinking about more then. And mind you, that at that time, I still had much more of a nostalgia about Iran, and I was very excited with my collaboration with the new group of people. Now, years later, of course, you know, my nostalgia has diminished to something else, and still working with this group, but that has somewhat changed. So in every dimension, there's been this evolution. It's just interesting for me to look back and examine the changes and the parallels that still existing to this date.
When you say those earlier works had more rawness, what do you mean by rawness?
Well, there's a naivety at the way in which I went about telling the stories. When I look back at the editing, for example, of Rapture, it's really unlike any cinematic work, the way that I'd never made a film before. And also, my logic of telling the story was so photographic, meaning that it was, always in relation, like, how do this circle of men look in terms of the triangle of the woman, and how would I disperse the woman on the beach while the men are in a line at the fortress? So there were, all the relationships were really highly aesthetic and visual, as opposed to having this overall defined narrative. But at the end, there was this one thing, a line of narrative, which was, I guess, more like an allegorical sort of concept of the woman migrating from the desert to the sea. Other than that, everything was so free form, and I was just not feeling very pressured about, well, does this make sense now, or do the audience get it? It was just like everything was just sort of go with the flow.
I read something in the exhibition catalog, and we're taping this, I should note, before the show opens. I haven't seen it yet. I read something in the exhibition catalog that I guess I must have known intuitively, but I'd never really thought about, and that is that you storyboarded out those, you know, the video works you made in the 90s and in the early 2000s. Have you ever exhibited or shown those storyboards, or do you keep those hidden in a drawer some way, not to be seen for many more decades?
I have all the storyboards, and at one point when Rizzoli was preparing to publish the book that they did, we were talking about including some of the storyboards, but that's, I don't know how it was eliminated. But it's true that we do storyboard. But I think even for the feature film Women Without Men, most of the scenes were storyboarded, because that's just the way that I think. I mean, right now I'm preparing a mood book for the next film, and I'm storyboarding. But storyboarding doesn't necessarily mean drawing now. For me, it's a kind of collage or assemblage of moving picture with photographs or, and then some drawings, you know. But before, my production designer was a very well-skilled drawer, and he would just draw it. But right now we use a lot of images and even moving pictures as creating a mood book or a story.
So someday we might see them.
I hope so.
One of the things that a catalog can make really clear is, you know, it can remind a reader or a viewer of, you know, a great deal amount of work in a small amount of time. And I had not forgotten how much the early work was intensely about gender in the Islamic world, but really comes strongly off of the page. And I found myself wondering, I mean, you hadn't lived in the Islamic world for many years when you started making those works in the late 90s, even Women of Allah going back into the mid-1990s. Why was it you wanted to make work about gender in the Islamic world when you hadn't lived there in almost 20 years?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One has a social dimension. The other is more personal dimension. But I think even in my generation, which was born before the Islamic Revolution, that you always felt this extreme distinction between being a woman and a man in that society, in a way that both the private and public lives were defined. For example, rarely the women were educated, where the men always were educated. Or certain inhibitions that women were defined by it, but men were very free of it. But of course not as an extreme case as after the Islamic Revolution. But sociologically speaking, after the Islamic Revolution, I felt that the way in which the women's lives were so heavily defined by the Islamic Revolution and changed, that by studying the woman in a way that you can study the Islamic Revolution, the ideology of the revolution, in many ways, the woman embodied the values of the men who took control. And this has been the case, I think, in most Islamic countries when they undergo a heavy Islamization or revolutions. The change of the woman's rights, for example, if they have to put on the veil, or if they have to be excluded from certain things, or if the legal system changes for divorce and this and that, from every dimension, the first thing that happens, let's say Egypt right now, the first thing they do is they apply their changes on the woman's situation. For example, they shouldn't be seen in certain places, they should be wearing the veil, etc. So for me, it was really a very interesting kind of way of framing my sociological question by looking at the woman and how you can see the changes in the country, in the regime, the ideology through the lives of the woman, if that makes any sense.
I guess you were so aware of all of those factors that even when you were living in California and New York, that they jumped out at you, that they maintained a presence in your worldview.
Well, the social part of it, it became more pronounced when I went to Iran, and I realized that the impact the revolution had women, and particularly even my own immediate family, how my mother, my sisters had changed. It's just mind-blowing in superficial to very profound dimensions. But on personal level, I guess you know, I, being born in Iran, I've always had issues in relation to the body, in relation to inhibitions. You know, I'm very uncomfortable with nudity, and I'm very, you know, I'm very inhibited. And I think, even though I've been away for so long, I'm very, very conscious of my sexuality, my femininity, my body. And I think these are something that you're born with and you struggle with, which is really a non-Western issue, I think. I'm not very comfortable with the body, you know, and so I'm very conscious of it.
So in the spirit of the exhibition, which surveys your work over a 20-year period, I'd like to talk about some things that, you know, I notice are constants or that run through many different pieces. And I want to start with, I've noticed that in many of the film installations, the bad guys, if you will, wear white. We see the bad guys, or the communists, I guess, and women without men wearing white. We see that in The Last Word, for example, or in Tuba. Why white for the bad guys?
Well, it goes back to my very first impressions when I went back to Iran, where it was very customary for the clergy or the in the bureaucracy in the country, the men worked, you know, white shirt with button shirts on the top. This became very, with a little bit of beard on their faces. These were very religious men who worked for the government and obviously very much identified with the regime. And that was it. Absence of a tie, button up on the top, and very often white. And to me, it always sort of represented people of power. But a lot of it, of course, was stylization and exaggeration of the reality, like I always do. And the play with this idea that the women were in black veil, very free form fabrics, and the men were in this white shirt, you know, very sort of geometric, you know, very. So for me, this idea of the segregation of the woman from the men, and also, like you said in The Last Word, the judge and his peers, also the people of power, were very much defined by those white shirts. But it were really kind of a stylization of my impressions initially, right after the revolution. And to this day, you see that a lot of the religious men more or less dress like that, maybe not white entirely, but they always button up in the back, in the top, and there's a way they look that just screams out that, you know, I am, you know, I'm part of the government and I identify with these guys. And so for me, it was sort of abstracting something that is based on reality.
And conversely, the heroes of your works typically wear black right through Book of Kings, the photographs you first showed last year. Is there any particular reason that the figures with whom the viewer is perhaps intended to empathize wear specifically black?
Yeah, I mean, I think the black also represented something very dark, very tragic. You know, the subject of martyrdom. I mean, oddly enough, the portraits that you're talking about from the Book of Kings remind me of the Woman of Allah, which was another concept of martyrdom, but in the post-revolutionary Iran or during the revolution, where, you know, people were voluntarily being killed or committing crimes on the name of faith. And here we had young people who were also devoted, but not to the religion, but to the idea of democracy. And so it was all about grief and mortality and tragedy and sorrow and sacrifice and all of those things that I just felt that black was most vividly, you know, sort of representative of, as opposed to white, which was more possibly suggesting an idea of hope or life or whatever, or power. In this case, was much more about the state of despair.
Many of your pieces, including Passage and Fervor and Rapture, include walking, lots and lots of walking. And obviously, on one hand, that's a metaphor for journey. But it's something that you've used a lot and in many pieces. And I wonder why walking particularly interests you as a technique or as a way of representing journey.
Well, I think perhaps more than walking is choreography. I mean, I look back at many of my work. I mean, it's been a long time. I've been studying dance, and this is just a very private part of my life. I'm very, very interested in the body and the space. And I think a lot of things have sort of developed very intuitively over the years. But when I look at Rapture, Passage, even Women Without Men, the shots of the, you know, the streets of the coup where the soldiers and the Black Togs and the Nationalists are all coming together, or even in Fervor, I mean, Endless, or Tuba, there's this endless amount of movement, mobility, migration, and very often the convergence of the crowds together and separating. So I think for me, speaking about the sense of choreography that I believe that is a very big part of, particularly my video installations, one example is Passage, where you have a circle of women in the desert and then a group of men walking in a line through the different landscapes. And later on, I mean, one can define what all the symbolism means, but I realized that there is a strong sense of choreography, as if like a dance, as it was in Rapture or in Women Without Men, that the relationship between these bodies moving in the landscape, it's very effective for me.
As a viewer goes through the show in Detroit, a viewer will inevitably recognize that you use many of the same people, actors, if you will, in your pieces. So, for example, we'll see a man in Fervor who resurfaces years later in The Last Word. Do you want viewers to make narrative connections between those figures and the roles they play in your work? Or is it more that you have a group of people with whom you're familiar working and that's just the way it is?
It's such an interesting connection because you made me think about it for the very first time. You're right. Like, for example, in Fervor, the guy who was the preacher or whatever, who was, you know, really like mean guy in negative role, again, in The Last Word, played the negative role.
The interrogator, if you will.
And lately overruled, you know, once again, he was, for me, he's like the perfect bad guy.
He has great eyebrows at the very, you know, the eyebrows are menacing.
Yeah, he has this charisma that it's almost frightening. And then you have someone that I photographed, Arita Shah, a woman that I photographed for Woman of Allah and later played in The Last Word as the poet who came to be interrogated. And then later in Woman Without Men, she played the older lady, Farouk Lera. So, you know, and she was never an actress and she was never a model, but it just, I always felt that her face, her image, her, you know, again, her persona fit my stories and my images very well. But I never actually connected to this that, yeah, I tend to use the same characters over and over again, but they always almost have either the victim or the role or the sort of the powerful role.
In many of your pieces, your protagonists or groups of protagonists have unusually intense physical contact with the earth. They're digging or they're pushing earth around in a way that maybe suggests digging. This is in Passage, this is in Tuba. What about that physical contact with the earth is important to you?
You're right, because I even when I think about it, I even have women floating in water like Mato. And then you got
And you just to extend it a bit further, in Tuba you frequently show people digging or clawing at the earth from above, and in Makdot we see her floating in water, and that's also shot from above.
It's really interesting you say that, and I have to say that there's this obsession that only recently I came to realize that when I was a student at Berkeley many, many years ago, I was obsessively drawing a woman floating in the water. And then also I was obsessively painting woman flying, which again in Munez, you see that a woman flies. And this idea of a woman becoming a tree, which became part of Tuba and eventually a part of the story of Women Without Men from Shahnishpar Sipur. So this integration or relationship of woman to nature has been also a poetic reference that Farouk Farrokhzad, a poet that I've often used in my, you know, in my inscribing in my photograph, often in a very visual way, writes about a woman planting herself or being wanting to be part of nature. I don't exactly have the explanation why, but now that you mention it, again, woman flying, woman floating in the water, almost becoming a vegetation, a woman turning it into a tree, growing as a tree, woman bringing the body back to the earth, like in Passage, and seem to be a repeated pattern. And to be honest, I don't know why, but they seem to be going back years and years ago when I was only in my 20s.
I guess maybe that connection with the earth is why water is so prevalent in so many pieces too. Soliloquy, Women Without Men.
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right. See, it would take someone like you to analyze this. I mean, it may be also that there is so much of my work that is sort of facing the political, social, oppressive issues, traditional religious issues, that somehow going back to earth and sort of digging yourself back into the earth, it's a way of a relief, you know, a way of escaping from all those definitions and going back to something very basic. You know what I'm saying? It's something very primal. And honestly, as you say, it really makes me think about why I was attracted to the story of Women Without Men. The idea that the orchard would represent that kind of scape, that kind of mystical, ephemeral space that was non-existent almost. It was almost like a space in your mind where when you came to the city, it really was about reality. So I guess there's this perpetual desire to link back again to nature as a way of escape, you know. And I think for most people, this is why we love nature so much, because it is a form of escape.
My guest is Shireen Nishat. We'll be right back after a break.
New art acquisitions join iconic favorites in the new Wolf Gallery for Contemporary Art at the Toledo Museum of Art. See notable works from the TMA collection by Chuck Close, Julian Schnabel, Marisol, Kehinde Wiley, Fred Wilson, Philip Guston, and others, along with newly acquired stunning works by Maya Lin and Peta Coin. The 6,000-square-foot, two-story gallery holds paintings, sculpture, photography, works on paper, and mixed media. Admission is free. Visit ToledoMuseum.org.
Next month, the Modern Art Notes podcast is going back on the road for a live audience taping. On May 10th, the Pulitzer Foundation for the Arts in St. Louis is opening Donald Judd, The Multicolored Works, the first exhibition devoted exclusively to Donald Judd's multicolored works. The show will feature over 50 pieces Judd created between 1984 and 1992. I'll be taping the Modern Art Notes podcast with exhibition curator Marianne Stockbrand at the Pulitzer on May 16th. Hope to see you there. Now, back to the show.
And I'm back with Shireen Nishat. So before the break, we were talking about some things that recur in many different pieces that you've made. Another one of those things is your use of groups of people. You only very rarely have protagonists that you approach in isolation. You know, even when you have a strong individual protagonist in a work, that person often is at some point or at one point in the film part of a group before you, say, separate them out, if you will. Why are you attracted, or why is it important to you that a narrative starts with, ends at, or includes a substantial group of people and not just one or two protagonists?
I think when I look at the earlier work, I separated a little bit from the more recent work where it was more video-based. I think it was, like you said, like in Rapture, the entire video was about a group versus a group. There was never even a single close-up of a single person, because the whole idea was based on the community, not about an individual, you see. Or often other films, I mean, and Passage as well, I think it was a group of men versus a group of women. But then you had in Fervor, where you're beginning to see individuals versus the community, you know, when you feel like an outcast, a question of being an outcast, or possessed, for example, a woman who was going mad versus the community. So I think the video-based work were, again, either the subject matters were really sort of devoid of the question of the psychological drama of a single person versus the entire collective environment, you know, group. And then later, really pursuing this question of being a rebel, being an outcast, being one person who is different than others. But again, dealing with them not so much as a narrative, psychological sense, but more as sort of allegorical way. Until I came to Women Without Men, which I fundamentally understood that that's where there is a difference between the language of cinema as opposed to video, because in cinema, it's all about the psychological development of the character, the protagonist, that you cannot, you know, talk sculpturally like I have been. Like, again, the people in my past videos were devoid of a character or an identity. They were more statues, sculptures, where in cinema, you had to take people to the inner worlds of the characters. Therefore, you had to make them feel like they feel comfortable, they know the character. And that was a very big challenge for me. But what remained constant was that all the women in The Woman Without Men were still cast and rebels and lonely and different. And their struggle was them versus the community, which became, if it makes any sense, a continuation of the previous work. So my latest preoccupation is to understand the nature of character studies, something that I really didn't do before. But my nature is to again, go after groups and groups visually and even sort of conceptually.
And I guess the last thing that pops up in a lot of the work that I wanted to ask you about is something I hadn't noticed until I went through the catalog for this show in Detroit, and that is how much architecture and built environment plays a role in your work. Buildings have almost personality in many of your pieces. And I wonder, obviously you're making conscious decisions about where to site works as you film them. How do you think through how you want buildings to look in your pieces, and how do you decide whether to use building A or building B when you shoot somewhere?
Well, I must mention that I worked about 10 years at the Storefront for Art and Architecture, which was an organization that was not only interested in architecture in terms of design and aesthetic, but architecture in relation to social responsibility, in relation to understanding the ideological nature of a culture, which was very fascinating. So for me, space and architecture, space meaning built or natural space and architecture, became a form of phenomena as a way of a cultural study, I have to say. And more than anything, I think, for example, in the video Soliloquy, where it was shot partially in Turkey and partially in the United States.
In Albany, I think.
Yes, Albany and the World Trade Center. I really tried to focus on use of architecture as the way that they defined the values of the society, the more corporate or capitalistic, as opposed to a very religious, traditional idea of a society, as this woman was sort of navigating between the two. Or, for example, in Women Without Men, let's speak about Zarin. You know, she was in the incredibly, you know, sensual space of the brothel, where, you know, it was very gay. It was like, you know, sex was everywhere. And then you went to the bathhouse where it was almost like an Orientalist painting of Jerome, a classic Islamic architecture. But then, you know, she was bleeding and as she was scrubbing herself. And then she went to the mosque where it was very sacred, etc. So for me, the relationship of this woman to a very sensual, erotic space of a bathhouse where all these women, naked boys are, to a religious space as a prostitute, how the different spaces as she inhabited them defined her situation in the culture and the problematics of being who she is. And then later with the other characters, we did the same. So for me, space, it's a way to reinforce the nature of the character in a visual form, you know, to describe the backgrounds of the character and to give a lot of information to the reader and to the audience that I would otherwise have to do through dialogues, I think.
You and I have, this is our fourth or fifth interview, and I realized in preparing to talk to you that I think the one body of work we've never, one of the two bodies of work we've never discussed is Women of Allah. And I have a couple things I'd like to ask about that body of work. A number of the Women of Allah photographs feature a rifle, a gun, and I myself did not know until a few weeks ago that gun is a Remington, an American-made rifle. Do you hope Americans recognize that gun as being American, or is it simply what you had access to in the 90s?
I wish there was, you know, more to it than the fact that at the time I used that weapon because I was a neighbor to some friends in upstate New York, where they were hunters. They used that weapon. And later in New York, I went to rent more weapons that are used for theatrical purposes, and I got what they had available. So there's no particular angle that I could claim for.
There's in almost all of the women of Alla photographs in which there is a woman, there is calligraphic writing on that woman's skin or eyeball, I guess, as the case may be in a couple pictures. In one of them, and maybe only one of them, the woman is unadorned by this calligraphy. And I'm thinking of an untitled piece from 1996 that also features your son, Cyrus. Why is the calligraphic marking on him in that picture and not on the woman's arm or hand? And did you think about that at the time?
You know, I was really questioning the issue of gender in the Islamic societies. And actually, I remember taking a trip to the north Iran, and one of my trips that I've gone after the revolution, by the sea. And it was just so extremely ironic that, you know, the woman had to be covered head to toe, you know, even there. And then the men were naked, the entire top, you know, with their nipples showing and everything. And of course, that's very sexual, but somehow it was completely acceptable. Or, you know, there are times where, you know, it's just disproportionate in terms of, you know, the amount of male body that you're allowed to see in Islamic world, that it doesn't make sense because it's very provocative. So it would have been a woman if they had, you know, their arms showing. So in that particular piece, I would just wanted, of course, it's an exaggeration. Again, it's a stylized piece. It's a very conceptual piece. But I wanted to touch on that absurdity of how, in fact, male body is not tabooed, where woman body is tabooed, and women are all to blame for provoking sexual attraction. Where, in fact, men could also be very provocative sexually. To see even a young boy, you know, completely naked at the age of 5, when you are, in fact, so inhibited, you know, a culture that closes the curtain on all possibilities of sex, and suddenly, you know, I'm walking down the street and I see a boy completely naked or a man topless. And so for me, it just wanted to, this piece really hints back at the absurdity of these ideas that don't quite make sense because they're not equal and they're not fair. One image that to me sort of just touched on that absurdity.
You know, there's only one body of your work I've never seen before, and that's Games of Desire, which I don't think has ever been shown in the United States. Why not?
Well, you know, this piece, I mean, first of all, you know, I only do gallery exhibitions with Barbara only every 3-4 years, and I haven't any other exhibitions anywhere else. But I think for a lot of people, this is an unknown project, and it's a kind of unfamiliar project because it's the first work that I did outside of a Muslim country. It was a commission that was made by a curator called Franz Morin, who lived in Laon Prabang in Laos. And I and many other artists like Anne Hamilton, Shazia Sikandar, Rikrit, Marina Abramovich, many people went and made work. And eventually it was published in a book. But for me, I felt like a tourist, you know, going there. And I went a couple of times with Shoja, my partner and collaborator, and try to find a thread in that culture that somehow I could have a handle on, that sort of made me feel like I could sort of connect to, that somehow maybe even resembled my own country. And mind you that they've had their own political catastrophes, revolutions, and takeover by the communists that has redefined a nation from, let's say, monarchy to the present state of a communist country. And the way in which this culture has been transformed heavily throughout these years, and the people are emotionally and morally and culturally divided by completely different identities, particularly the older people. So what I went after was to go after a particular type of music that exists only now with elderly people, that goes back of a root of years and years ago, that it's about kind of a courting between men and women. But now in their 80s and 70s, it's highly sexual and playful. And so we went and recruited the older men and women in different villages that still knew this type of songs and music and found them instrumentalists, and created this double projection, projections like Turbulent, there a man sang, a woman answered, except the difference was that it was very joyous, very playful, and really overtly sexual and almost perverse in the way that they spoke to each other. And then I created this group of diptychs between men and women. But I think at the end, you know, in terms of the market or whatever, people, you know, ask for signature work and they expect, you know, from me, you know, work of Muslim nature, and maybe this wasn't the type.
And it's not in the Detroit show.
No, it's not in. Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
So you've been the subject of many monographic shows. You've participated in as many monographic museum shows as any artist I can think of. So you're obviously willing to do them and to participate in them. Why? Why are you so willing to do them? What do you get out of them?
You mean kind of a mid-career retrospective?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, usually I'm very flattered when people ask me, but I think the last time that I did do this was back in 2001, which was initiated
in the United States.
In the United States. I actually was looking back at my biography. The last time that I did a monographic exhibition was in Greece in 2008 or 7. I mean, I think that in the case of my work, it's always interesting to see the work in retrospect, because the way the work has evolved from photography to video to more cinematic work. My work really only makes sense when you look at it in that sense of evolution, that kind of retrospect. Because I don't continue with photography, or I don't just continue with video, but I do everything. So I think for an audience, which is very difficult to do in a gallery, to put up this much work, it's hard to contextualize the work. And I think a museum can really do that. Mind you, that is very demanding because, you know, for example, the show at Detroit, it would take hours to see. So people have to come back and visit. But I think you cannot quite see my work in the proper light in a gallery, or, you know, but you can in a museum, because first of all, the lengthiness of it, but also the way in which they work with each other and demands a lot of space.
Although Book of Kings certainly worked well in a gallery installation context. In fact, you got kind of a physical experience with it in that kind of a more intimate space.
But I'm very glad you talked about the Book of Kings, because, you know, it's very difficult to show this piece at many places because of the number of work. But I have just finished a new body of 15 photographs that sort of closes the chapter on the Book of Kings that I have just shot in Egypt. But to me, this requires like a museum, because we had 65 photographs from the Book of Kings, and now I've just added 15, and there's a video of Overruled. It's hardly possible to imagine a space of a gallery that could accommodate all of that, but a museum could do that.
Well, Shireen Nishat, congratulations on the show, and thanks so much for talking with me again.
Thank you, Tyler, for your continuing support. Really, I appreciate it.
Rome in the 1600s was the heart of European art and architecture, and Bernini was the most famous artist of the day. His spectacular sculptures adorn many of Rome's important spaces. At the Kimball, Bernini's genius is revealed in an international exhibition of his terracotta models, the brilliant inspiration for some of the most beloved sculpture in the world. Bernini, Sculpting in Clay, at the Kimball Art Museum, February 3rd through April 14th.
Welcome back. My next guest, Kelly Richardson, makes some of the most fantastical video installations you'll ever see. Her work mixes hyperrealism, which is sometimes rooted in earthly reality, and other times, such as in her recent Mariner 9, is rooted in data that scientists have gleaned from the topography of Mars. Her work typically addresses our concerns about man's use of the planet, and in the case of Mariner 9, other sites in the solar system. A mid-career survey of her work is on view at the Albright Knox Art Gallery. Kelly Richardson, welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thanks very much.
I want to start by going to the roots of your work, or maybe what came before your work. Were you ever interested in massive scale epic landscape painting or large scale photography, or did you come to size and realism through something else?
I think that's something that actually was developed over time in my practice. Much earlier on, I was interested in capturing moments, kind of insignificant small moments that were loaded with conflicting sensations. And I guess over time, the ideas and maybe the focus on the sublime drew me to making much larger immersive spaces.
I was going to ask about that next, because your early work has much more of a narrative thread through it, much more of kind of a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, a story that ends with a thing.
Yeah, a couple of them do.
Yeah, and I was wondering how you transitioned from something more deliberately narrative to something, I don't know, more abstract that opens up a range of potential narratives that the viewer then kind of puts together or solves or considers in their his or her own head.
I guess a couple of things that I didn't want to demand time from people. I wanted to create spaces that people could spend as little or as much time with the work as they would like, but also creating moments that just seem to last forever so that they operate in ways where the viewer can properly lose themselves in the work and unpack it and on a personal level, and the length of time that each viewer needs to do that varies. So I wanted to create spaces more or less that just lasted forever.
Is trompe-l'oeil or hyperrealism a particular art historical interest of yours?
Yes, no. I try to create just believable landscapes that are obviously part real, part unreal, but believable.
So you've obviously become really interested in scale and in positioning the viewer in a really vast landscape. And I've read you talk about being interested in being in those actual spaces, the real spaces yourself, be it an expanse of Western Canada or the American West or a national park or what have you. How do you think through migrating your interest in scale into the works? I mean, obviously you can just make them really big, but is there more to it that you bring? Is there more to scale you bring to the conception of a piece than just its size in a wall, on a wall or in a room?
I think I just use it in a way that it engulfs the viewer, so in a really practical sense.
It does, and your pieces do, even when they're on a flat wall and not kind of, you know, curving around and physically enveloping a viewer very much has the sense of, you know, being in a massive kind of Northern Canadian sods or something. I wonder how much you play with where in a composition, where in the field you put the horizon line.
Well, most of the time it's at kind of like a first person human level perspective, so that you can imagine yourself in that landscape.
Standing around the landscape.
Yeah, so that in a gallery space, when it's projected large enough, it seems life size, and it seems that you could literally step into this other space. I often refer to them as set extensions in a way that they operate like set extensions in the film industry, only in a gallery space, and it leads you into another time and place.
So how do you decide where to put the horizon line? So for example, let's take the erudition, where the horizon line is at times in the piece really distinct, really lit with a white glow. How did you decide where the horizon line would be and should be relative to where the viewer is, so you get that feeling like you're on the edge of walking into it?
That's a tough question to answer cleanly.
Well, I can give you one reason it's something I think about is when I look at the photograph, say, of Edward Muybridge. Muybridge loves to position the viewer as if the viewer is hovering above, you know, the Yosemite landscape, so that if the viewer were to step forward into a Muybridge photograph, you'd fall down. You'd fall down hundreds or thousands of feet. Whereas Carlton Watkins, for example, Muybridge's great contemporary, almost never did that. You could always take a step forward and inhabit a Watkins. And in your pieces, if your horizon line was in a different place, say if it was lower, somebody standing in a gallery would feel like they were hovering over it. And if the horizon line was higher, you would feel like you were looking up at it. So it seems to me that where you place that, I don't know, in painting terms, the vanishing point, is extremely important.
Well, yeah, but that goes back to what I was saying about trying to place both the horizon line and also the scale of the things in the landscape themselves as in a way that feels like it is just first person, you know, my height relatively speaking, so that it does feel like you could just walk in. I am actually going to be working on a piece now where the perspective is much, much higher deliberately, but with the air edition, it was about feeling like you could walk into that landscape, but also leaving enough room to communicate the scale of the trees in amongst a rather large kind of lonely sky.
One of the things that's popped up in your work a lot in the last half decade is the impact of man on the planet, how man is damaging the planet. How did that become an interest to you? Why did that begin to come into the work?
It's always actually been an interest of mine, I think, I'm not sure how old you are, but my whole life we've been talking about environmental issues and what would happen if we, you know, kind of don't rein in ourselves on the whole. And we're kind of at breaking point, really, environmentally speaking. We have just a few years left to get ourselves under control and or face really unthinkable consequences. And in fact, that's where we're headed currently. So I think there isn't actually a bigger issue out there for us today. It's the biggest issue I think we've ever really faced globally as a species, and it really should be the number one issue that we are tackling. And so it's always been there, but it's the severity of the situation now where it's coming out more in the work, I guess.
Could you talk about how that interest exists in Leviathan, a film installation you made that was commissioned by Art Pace in San Antonio a couple years ago?
Yeah, when I was invited to Art Pace, the BP oil spill had just happened, and I never like to work really literally with ideas, but I did want to create something inspired by that, or more appropriately inspired by the idea of water contamination. And so I found this lake in a place called Uncertain, Texas.
In far east Texas, north of Houston, not far from Shreveport.
That's right.
Louisiana.
And it's the largest cypress forest in the world. And they say it's the only natural lake of any significant size in Texas. It's also actually the first site for overwater or through water oil exploration in human history, which is fairly significant. And so with Leviathan, I filmed this, what ends up being a 48-foot by 9-foot panoramic view of a swamp, cypress forest swamp. And in the water are yellow tendrils, snake-like tendrils, which move independently of the water. They look like some kind of perhaps contamination of some sort, but as they move independently, it could be a life form of some description.
So we mentioned your narrative works earlier. In the middle of your career, you shifted from making works where the viewer stood in front of an object or a scene to making the works we've been discussing, in which you pretty much encourage the viewer to think they're standing in the landscape itself. Why was that an important transition?
Gosh, I don't know. It just happened naturally.
Did it happen because you had access to bigger grants and facilities and you could do bigger things, or was that something you've long been interested in being able to do?
Well, I've always been an idea-based artist. That when I graduated, I actually studied drawing and painting, and when I graduated, I really began to question why I was drawing and painting. It felt like I was a bit of a slave to the medium, and I never really questioned it. I just went into it because I was interested. So I started focusing on ideas, and that's when, if the idea dictated that I would make a sculpture, I made a sculpture and so on, and video and photography entered my practice. And over time, it just took over quite naturally. And I would say that that is true as well for where the work has developed or how the work has developed. In 2000, and I'm largely unfunded, by the way, with regards to grants, I'm mostly unfunded. But in 2001, I had this idea where I wanted to take this moment from a B movie in a piece called Car Stopped at a Stop Sign in the Middle of Nowhere in Front of a Landscape, rather long title. And I wanted to take that moment and make it last forever. And I went to a production house in Toronto to get a quote for having the work produced because I didn't have the equipment myself. And they quoted me $5,000, but to buy a brand new Mac, which actually they had just released Macs, which were capable of editing video at home for the first time, was a little bit cheaper than that. So I got a second job saved up some money and bought my first kit. And that really, really changed my practice. Having the tools myself really changed my practice. And I would say that even though I have the tools and have had them really since 2001, software has continued to develop, etc., making certain ideas actually possible. And then, of course, as my skill set grows, more ideas are possible. But with every single piece, I still honor ideas first. And with every single piece, generally means that I have to learn new software or aspects of a software program and new skills to produce the work.
Your newest piece, Mariner 9, which was just acquired by the Albright Knox, is a remarkable example of that. Why? And so I'd like to ask a few things about it. First, why did you choose to leave the Earth?
Why not? Well, with the idea of Mariner 9, particularly with regards to the future that we face, what I was interested in is this really beautiful endeavor of ours to find life on another planet, to know that we're not alone in the universe while destroying life we know to exist on this planet at a truly terrifying rate. And it had to be told from Mars.
Why did you set it on Mars in a way that was hundreds of years hence, in a way that reveals what we've left there, if you will?
Yeah, kind of an elephant's graveyard of space travel and missions to Mars. It's a kind of ultimate futurescape, if you will. And again, scientists and futurologists can present data for us to contemplate. But I think when we actually experience a futurescape and visualize it, it becomes much more tangible. So this is set 200 to 300 years into the future. Some of the spacecraft are still partially functioning in a very futile way, still attempting to find signs of life and then possibly transmitting that data back to no one.
Is making a large work about a place you've never been, obviously, substantially different from making a work rooted in, say, the Lake District of England?
Though the process was very, very different. I could have faked Mars. I could have gone to Arizona maybe and filmed in Arizona and then digitally inserted these spacecraft. But I found out that NASA knows how Mars is constructed and had released that data to the public. And then in theory, you could bring that data into a 3D program and recreate the lay of the land faithfully. So assuming that none of us are going to probably go to Mars. Well, I'm not, even if the option, I'll speak for myself. I wanted to create as faithfully as possible an experience of Mars without going.
Sound is a big part of all of your room-sized installations. It's often really subtle, but it's really important. How did you decide what Mars would sound like, and how did you build that?
It's a tricky one, that, because in my research, I discovered that no audio recordings have ever been made of Mars. So there's some theory as to how sound might bounce around Mars, but short of being able to replicate Mars in reality, it's only theory. So I kind of came up with sort of ominous wind sound that is quite familiar, but ominous at the same time. So a little bit alien.
It's also a sound that seems to move around the space.
Yes.
Does that make sense? How do you, so when the viewer is standing in front of the piece, the viewer is in a fixed position and the piece is in a fixed position, is it important to you that the sound enters the space in a way that makes the viewer think things are going on all around them?
With that piece, it's the first 5.1 surround sound audio that I've made. And again, I'm trying to create these immersive environments. And with Mariner 9, there's a dust storm happening at the same time as these little craft are still attempting to do their jobs. But so I wanted you to feel like you were in the center of what potentially a dust storm might sound like on Mars.
Kelly Richardson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this week's show. The Modern Art Notes podcast is edited by Wilson Butterworth. Special thanks to Steve Roden, who created the sound for the program. The Modern Art Notes podcast is released under a Creative Commons license. Please visit Modern Art Notes for more information. Thanks for listening.